Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kawula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host with the most, Nikki Kawula. We're here with an amazing actor, comedian, and writer, good friend of over a decade, 15 years plus. High five in the house.
There you go.
Mr. Alex Carver. Say hello, Alex.
Hello, everyone.
Our studio audience loves you already. Woo! Woo-hoo-hoo! You see them all just hiding amongst us.
They're out there, yeah.
So, dude, you know, I know you, and I didn't know that you were, like, such a headstrong writer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I love it more than anything.
I had no idea.
Yeah, grew up playing baseball, and I love writing more than I ever loved playing baseball.
Wow.
It's just the greatest. It's, you know, it's a joy. And a lot of what I do is comedic.
Right.
So, you know, so for me, it's a chance to take things that, you know, piss you off in life,
right,
and turn them into
therapy.
Into comedy. It is. It's like therapy. It's like taking something that bothers you and making it, comedic or funny. And it's a real chance to put it in a light that makes you able to deal with it a lot better and understand it and enjoy the moments. There's no bad moments.
And the crazy thing is so we're going to get to the novel, but like writing a novel, it has this roller coaster of a ride.
Yeah.
So like when you're writing really funny things, are you sitting there like, ha ha, that's clever. Are you reacting the way a reader would react?
Yeah. It's funny because I think a lot of the good stuff comes out in going over and over it. So, you know, you may have a couple of funny things in the first draft.
Right,
but then you get to the second and third, and you find something, a line that ends the chapter or the scene, and you hadn't had that line. You knew there was something there that you were looking for, and then you get it, and it's always a pump of the fist. Yeah, like I literally, you know, celebrate like it's Game 7 of the World Series. It's a great feeling.
When you think, oh, the funny thing is, I make the same parallel with songwriting. For me. Yeah. It's like I feel like my whole day is a win if I write something that I know was really good, even if it's something small. Oh, yeah. It doesn't matter if it's a guitar line, if it's a verse, if it's a whole song, whatever it is. If I write something that I know is good, my whole day has value.
Oh, it's a great feeling.
You know what I'm saying?
It's a great feeling, yeah. And some days it's just hashing out, you know, ideas and plot lines, and then when you get I know what it's like to write. I've written a couple of songs myself because my wife sings, and
oh, right on.
So yeah,
I remember you telling me that actually.
Yeah. She's a great singer, so I've started writing stuff for her, and I know that it's like writing a poem,
right?
And it's really a good feeling to get, you know, to tell a little story like that in a few minutes, you know. So yeah, there's a lot of emotion and
well, let's go way back now. Where did you grow up, and how did you kind of get into? You must have gotten into books first, you know, like who were your favorite authors? Who were the kind of the bigger influences as you got into this?
Yeah, I would say that probably it wasn't so much the reading as it was the comedy that I just fell in love with. You know, I mean, I'm sure you were a fan of like Three's Company.
Oh, yeah, and big time.
Don Knotts.
Oh, yeah.
John Ritter. Yeah. And, you know, there's so many comedians that I saw early on that I just loved. And I love that they could have these moments where it was like magic. Suddenly they said something and it just,
right.
your head blew up, you know.
It was well, so and funny. It even started for me with like the Three Stooges, oh, the Little Rascals, great. Like, because it was just very strategic writing for who they were and what you were seeing visually. You know what I mean? So like some of the lines or the characters that they would just kind of like, the lines would like evolve into the characters, and sometimes the characters would evolve into the lines of further developing the character that they're playing. You know?
You're right. So, and there were so many flavors. And it's funny because when those shows were, you know, from yesteryear as far as our childhood were concerned, like the Monkees, I remember being very funny, and Abbott and Costello and all these shows. But they were long before our time, but they were showing it on TV. So we had all these different flavors to choose from. And there's some zany, crazy stuff, you know?
You're like, how did this get on here?
Yeah, like the Monkees. It was like a passport to kind of watching those shows. They were so zany, you know? And they were really kind of a great little band, too.
Yeah.
So, but they were funny. And so that I was just crazy about, you know, those shows like the Monkees. And
it's funny that you bring up the Monkees, because my first day at work in a guitar center, this is like 15, 16 years ago, Peter Tork walked in.
Oh, that's great.
And I was like, dude, you're Peter Tork? And I was so starstruck. And like this girl next to me was like, who's that? I'm like, the Monkees? Are you crazy? I grew up on the Monkees. You know what I mean? It was just like, it was like seeing a Beatle. You know, that day. The whole day was made, you know?
They were like the American Beatles, right?
Yeah. So like, where did you grow up, by the way?
So outside of Philadelphia in a town called Radnor. And I'd love to say I was from the gritty streets of Philadelphia, you know, Rocky.
Why don't you just say that?
Hey, how you doing? You know? But I definitely from, you know, 20 minutes outside, you know, safely, you know, far enough away where I could be, you know, live safely.
Right.
And
right.
But also, you know, close enough where we could go to see the Phillies. I'm a huge baseball fan, and go into the city and experience the city. And, you know, it's I don't know if you've been to Philadelphia that much.
Oh, yeah. I played a bunch at Arcadia University.
Oh, great.
All over Philly. I love that city. Yeah, I love actually all of Pennsylvania. I think it's like one of the gem states of the United States.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's definitely a fire-breathing city, though, as it gets a reputation for being. It's, you know, people are really high-strung, but there's no bullshit. I mean,
there's characters,
it's refreshing.
Too. That's what I love.
Oh, yeah.
Even in, like, the sticks of Pennsylvania, you get these characters where you're like, man, these are, like, really colorful people. So I can just see how you fell in love with comedy, just, like, with seeing the cast of characters that you may have just been around, or just kind of, like, you know, walking into a store and you just hear banter from the town folk. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the first time I started getting laughs was because I could imitate all my teachers in school. So I'd come in 5 minutes early before they arrived, and I'd take on, you know, Mr. Austell and Mr. Auk. They all seem to have eight last name.
Only
and
one
Dr. Piercy, you know, and I would do it, and then they'd come in, and the other teachers started to make me do it for them.
Wow.
Which was scary, because I was like, I never wanted to do the invitation for the teacher.
Right.
But I think that's why I first started getting some laughs, and you know, and so that sort of, you know, led or bled into wanting to make comedy, create comedy.
And did you do any theater in high school?
Yeah, I did. I just played baseball in high school, and then I went to college to Dickinson College, and I was in the Mermaid Players there, which was a dramatic arts, you know, society in the college. A troupe, yeah. And did a ton of plays, did the Shakespeare.
I was about to say, I know you did Shakespeare.
Yeah, but I was
that's
never,
a given.
It was funny, I was never cast as like the big, you know, like Gloucester, or any of the big roles. I was always the comic relief. Yeah, I was the guy who had the high voice and yelled at people and you know, stormed off in a tizzy fit, you know. So I get to play all those roles. I was always cast, you know, as the character roles or whatever, never I always wanted to be the leading man. And
right.
Never was.
It was you're always like, no. You gotta, I want to be the funny guy.
Just do the funny thing that you do and be quiet.
You know? Did you ever do stand-up?
Okay. Yeah, I did stand-up. I did stand-up for a number of years, probably about 10 years.
Wow.
And sketch comedy as well.
We did a jailbreak show in 2003.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's high five. That's great.
That was so good.
You guys were great, dude. As a contribution.
You were great, man.
Shows.
Oh, man. My dad still talks about your Tom Cruise impersonation. Oh, he still talks about it.
Yeah.
You got to do it. You got to do it.
I'll do the laugh.
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty great to be here.
I saw the video.
Freak it out, man.
Is there a couch I can jump on? Because I need to jump on a couch right now. Could somebody bring in a goddamn couch?
Yes, that was awesome. Dude, your Tom Cruise is ridiculous. All right, so when did you come to L.A.? What year did you come?
Came to L.A. in 1995.
Wow.
So, yeah. And I was here for maybe 3 years. Then I went to Chicago and did Second City for a year or something like that.
That's and Bill Murray, Harold Ramis.
All those guys. They and that city's a lot of fun, too.
Yeah.
That's
like a huge honor, dude.
Yeah. I really liked that 1 year. It was fun. I lived with my best friend from high school, and it was like the show Bosom Buddies, you know,
right.
Just like hilarious, you know.
Actually, what was the best thing you learned?
Throw the fruit in the grocery store, and catch it in the bags. It's, you know, like,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
What was the best thing you learned from Second City?
Best thing I learned from Second City, probably just, you know, the importance of really listening to people when they're, you know.
Yeah.
You see it in movies, too, and somebody's really a great listener. And, you know, sometimes they'll be such a good listener that they'll turn the camera on the guy who's not speaking because the other guy's doing a much better job than the guy talking. It's a real slap in the face to an actor.
I'm going to start noticing that.
I'm talking here, and the camera is facing in the opposite direction. That's me.
That's real acting.
Right. So I guess it pays to be a good speaker and listener.
And did you do like improv as well, or was it more sketch?
I did. Yeah, I did improv. I did all of those things. You know, improv, sketch was really fun. Which, you know, I did with you and some great friends for a while. And so I get to sort of taste all the different forms of comedy. And stand up was really fun. And it was funny because I did rely on that Tom Cruise impression so badly.
It's so good.
Yeah. And I realized that I couldn't do it in the beginning of a set, because if I did in the beginning, you know, they'd keep yelling, you know, do Cruise again. Throughout
the thing. You're like, dude, I got other jokes.
Bring back Cruise. that had to be the closer. You know,
you're like, I know what I need to do. I need to end with this thing.
That's right.
So what comedic writers were you a huge fan of?
I love, you know, it's funny, I'm not Jewish, but I love the great Jewish writers. Woody Allen, I loved.
Yeah.
And Larry David.
Yeah.
I just love that. I love neurotic comedy because I'm very, you know, neurotic too. And so I love that kind of writing. I read everything Neil Simon wrote.
Those are also my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
Throw in Harold Ramis and you got all of them.
Oh, he's amazing. Yeah, brilliant. So there's basically, I mean, but really, I know Woody's going through a tough time.
Right. He always is. Isn't he always?
Yeah.
Isn't he perpetually always going through a terrible time?
It seems like he's, he's
just
he's
doesn't
out
have
there
his shit
guy.
Together.
Yeah, he's, you know, I'm really, you know, not satisfied with my career right now because I think I might have blown it.
I always find that he has these like amazing, you know, huge sparks of brilliance.
Yeah.
And then it's clouded by how kind of weird and kind of aloof he is socially.
Yeah.
You know, like he just like either choices or like
Definitely.
Something he says in the press or something he does. It's just always like he's got this awkwardness. But then you see like a movie like Midnight in Paris. It's still, I still watch that movie all the time. And I'm like, what a brilliant, brilliant movie.
I've seen that about 10 times.
It's so good. It's so good.
It's brilliant. And if you love those, the characters that, you know, Hemingway and Fitzgerald and all those guys, and he obviously
worshipped
that period of time, 1920s.
And they nailed it. They nailed all the characters.
It is so good. And the actors they chose and the casting, it was like really like a passport to go back to that era, you know, and then adding the comedy. Yeah, it was, that was a masterpiece.
Do you remember, like, what was the moment of Zen that made you fall in love with either movies, acting, writing, or the combination of all of it?
Oh, the funny thing is, the first movie I ever saw was not a comedy. It was a movie called The Red Balloon.
I know The Red Balloon.
You know this? It's a French film.
Dude, you just gave me chills, dude.
Yes.
Dude, and it follows the kid around.
Yes.
Dude, high five. No one knows that movie.
I know, I love that movie.
Dude, that's one of my favorite movies. I cannot believe you just said that. Yeah. They used to show it in our classroom all the time.
Oh, it's beautiful.
So well done.
Yeah, and I was probably maybe 5 years old. My mom took me to see that. I don't know what the movie theater was or where it was, but it's like a 20-minute movie. So
yeah.
You know, it's odd that we leave the house to go out for 20 minutes.
She's like, I gotta take this kid to do something.
I gotta get him out. He's downstairs.
He's bouncing off the walls. Yeah, this Red Balloon movie looks like
pulling
it could
up
be
the bathroom tiles with the plunger right now. He needs to get out. But no, I saw that movie and this little boy who had become friends with a red balloon because he was sort of a loner and an outcast and everything, and he gets bullied and the kids are trying to get the balloon. They finally pop the balloon.
Right.
And then the last scene is that all these other balloons come to him in his apartment in Paris. And he grabs onto all these strings.
And he just floats away.
He floats away with the balloons over the
rooftops. Oh my God, I can't believe you brought up that movie.
Oh, it's just a mad.
Nobody knows that movie.
I was hooked after I saw that movie. I just really, that storytelling, that kind of, fantasy story.
Minimalist too. It's total minimalist.
Yes, you're right. Right. Just a great premise and a really touching storyline. Yeah. And that was the first first film I ever saw where I fell in love with storytelling because of that. Because it was so emotional and so sad.
Yeah.
But then they had me with the sadness and then this euphoric, glorious ending where I just
You relate to every part of it too. You know, it's like you see every facet of it. The crazy thing is so I did this music video about 5 or 6 years ago and we had a little kid with a balloon in the video. And like I made this red suit and did this whole thing and we didn't discuss anything red. Nobody talked about any color theme in the video. And I showed up in a red suit. There's a red ballerina. There was the girl had a red balloon. The silk aerialist had a red silk that she was, it was like everything that had all these themes, red drums, red keyboard. There was a woman with like bright red hair. It was just like all these red things coming together. And the crazy thing is everybody was like, oh, so was the red thing planned? It was like, no. So it was, that movie was a big reason why I was so happy that the balloon was red.
Subconsciously.
Yeah. And I never mentioned it, but nobody knows that movie. Right. Nobody knows that movie. I even mentioned it on the day of the shoot and people were like, I've never seen it. It was like, oh, well, it was a movie. It was like in the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I swear that red is my favorite color. Most of my cars have been red.
Wow.
I wear a lot of red.
Your book is red.
My book is
bright red. Yeah. Did you choose that?
I think it started with the same. That's amazing. I really do think that was something. It's amazing what these influences that
those
strike
subtle,
you. Your formative years.
Yeah.
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 And something about that. But yeah, I definitely pepper my life with red. Chairs and
that's
stuff
crazy.
In the house. I painted our rocking chair red. And
that's awesome.
That weird?
I love it.
Oh, we just figured
no,
that
it's
out.
Like a power color. There's definitely something about it.
Yeah, it's alive. It's
Let me ask you this. Before we get to your book, so you came from Second City, and did you move back to L.A.?
Yeah, I moved back to
In
L.A.
In 95? That's when you, or is that after?
I think I was back in like 2000, something like that. And then,
and what made you come back? You were like, I need to be here.
It just,
this is where
it
all
just
of it
felt
is.
Like, you know how certain places feel like they're the center of the universe?
Yeah.
I mean, this place to me just has always felt like you know, and Chicago, no offense to Chicago.
Right. That's
it's
no,
a, it's a great
that's
city.
No small feet of a city.
Right. But it's windy and cold and really humid. No, but it, it just, you know, this has always felt like for story, people who love storytelling.
Yeah.
This feels like the center of the universe. And, you know, there's a lot of play, you know, cities I love. I love San Francisco and, you know, Paris.
York
would be great to live in Paris, right?
I always think about Paris.
Oh, man.
Like, I didn't realize how much, and I'd been to Paris a couple of times, but I'd never realized the music scene in Paris was so vibrant.
Oh, wow.
So I haven't been back as a musician looking for gigs in Paris since I've been a musician. So I would love to live in Paris just for that reason.
My wife and I on our honeymoon went to a jazz a place where they were playing jazz in Paris, and it was a converted. It used to be like a jail, underground jail, and like there was like a torture room and everything, all stone, and it had these, you know, they still had the bars and the thing.
Wow,
the best jazz music we've ever heard.
That's amazing.
Just blown away that they turned this.
And it's
this
a horrifying huge. Place it's like the jazz capital, really, right now.
Oh,
more than New York. New York is up there, but Paris seems to be where it's really happening, where there's no like sense of like borders, you know. New York has like, oh, is that's the kind of music you're doing? Oh, that's cool. But Paris doesn't have that that like judgment, you know what I mean?
Because
I think they always have felt a little bit outside of that jazz scene, because jazz was born in the U.S. you know what I mean? So Paris like doesn't have those. It's just wanting to just be a part of it, and now it's become
a big deal,
a huge deal. It's probably the mecca, the, you know, of jazz music right
That's
now.
So interesting.
It it's funny that you said you brought up Paris.
Yeah, it must fit in pretty well with the, you know, with the Parisian lifestyle or the pace of things or something.
Right.
I mean, there must be something that, right, that connects to the...
But you know what? All said and done, L.A. still is one of these cities that is, it's kind of the trend-setting, you know, fabric of music, entertainment, film, writing, fashion, in the same way that Paris is, in a different way. But I still feel like you're right. Like, LA is always going to be this monster of a city.
Oh, that's great.
You know what I mean? So it's interesting that you came back and you kind of like found your way. You were in a sketch comedy group. So this is around the time. How did you meet Joe and Eddie?
Those guys. I met them at a doing sketch, but I had met a friend who I was doing stand up with, named Daniel Kino. And he's a Russian comedian, and I think he's out doing stand up still to this day, and pretty successfully. And but anyway, he pulled me in. He said, "Hey, we need another guy to do in our sketch comedy group." And I ended up, you know, and he ended up pulling me in. He'd seen the Tom Cruise impression.
So good.
That was my ticket. You know, it's hilarious. Just everybody's like, "You got to see this impression."
That was a great show.
Oh yeah.
Honestly, you know what? The funny thing is, like, I'm sure you feel this way because I watch Saturday Night Live.
Oh
and
yeah.
And I even have a friend that plays in the band, and I always just want to text him and just be like, "Yo, man, the music's better than the sketches now. Yeah. The sketches are so weak.
It goes through cycles.
They're
doesn't
so
it?
I mean, like mediocre. They haven't been great since the like '90s." You know,
it's so important. I mean, it's so it's all up to the talent. I mean, you get a Will Ferrell in there, or Dana Carvey, or
Mike Myers.
I mean, guys who have that unbelievable level of talent, and then you can just you know, you can write for them because they can do anything and they can create these brilliant characters.
Right.
But when you don't have that, those guys with the tour de force talent. You know,
well, it's just the reckless
voices, impressions.
Oh my God!
And
Chris Farley,
characters,
Chris Farley, Rob Schneider, Adam Sandler, and those guys bouncing off each other.
Yeah,
it's better than anything they did, you know, outside of Tommy Boy. But outside of, you know, what those guys did in films, that was like one of the peaks of what they were doing.
Incredible. And I always think, you know, that they do a big disservice to the show, and they have they should always have a guest who's funny.
Right.
Because most of the sketches revolve around, you know, the special guest. So if you have someone who doesn't play comedy or feel comfortable with it, you have Jim Carrey on an episode, you know, as the host.
Great.
It's going to be amazing. always.
You know, sometimes though, you can, like, one time they had Michael Jordan on, and like I remember his monologue, and it's still one of my favorite monologues.
Yeah.
It was like a very, like, you know, just flatline monologue, and he said, you know, I've done a lot of advertisements. This is an advertisement that you haven't seen, and it was for like some girl's douche, like, you know, like, and he's like, and he's walking along this river, and he's like, you know, I do shoes, I do Gatorade, but this one didn't quite make it. It was just like, that was a slam dunk.
That was a slam dunk. It was putting a guy who you see in one particular situation in a completely different one. Like him, and he was, you know, that guy was as big an athlete as he's ever been.
And so let me ask you, being a writer, you being a badass actor, comedian, and writer, when you see something like that, does it inspire you to make better comedic writing possible, or, you know, art? Like, does it inspire you, or does it frustrate you? Is it both? Because it frustrates me for the people I know, like yourself, that are so gifted, and I'm like, how is this the best that they're showcasing? You know what I mean?
You know, that really is frustrating to watch. It really is. I mean, I will say, like I said, that it does go through, you know, through waves, and you have great casts and great, you know, there have been many. But when they're bad and the level of talent is, you know, one-dimensional, sometimes they're just, you know, they're like, it's like a five-tool athlete, right? You get like a five-tool comedian who can be a great writer.
Right.
He can do impressions.
Right.
He can do physical comedy, which there isn't enough of, man. There's nothing better than physical comedy.
I mean, Kramer is one of my favorite. Oh. You know, he's one of the best at physical comedy.
Unbelievable.
Even on like UHF, he was like that.
Yeah.
You know?
So. And Jim Carrey and Charlie Chaplin. Yep. I mean, you can go, the names just come right out of your, you know, right to your head when you think of the best of them. And yeah, Michael Richards was, you know, I still watch Seinfeld
all the time. All the time.
Die laughing at his amazing physical comedy. And you don't see it in movies enough anymore, or on SNL, or, you know, I think the writers have lost that that enjoyment, or realizing just how much. I don't think anything makes me laugh more than great physical comedy.
Right.
Rowan Atkinson, Mr. Bean.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just.
They're gifted.
Yeah, they're just like ballet dancers.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. They're like the classic clown.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And I think, so you have these guys who can do all those things, and there's some of them out there that are just so, I mean, Steve Martin, I mean, he can write it. He can, you know, he can do the characters. He can do the voices. He can do, you know, but those guys are also very, very rare. So.
But this is all what influenced you to start writing shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And you started getting into writing short form. Like, there was an art to that had to influence you just being into sketch comedy and stand up. Those are like the real estate for the timing of what you're saying, the storytelling, the comedic elements. It's all about that short, concise brevity.
That's a great point. I think, you know, I started out doing sketch and bits for stand-up comedy. So I learned how to tell small little stories first before I expanded, you know. And with writing, the same thing. It's, you know, I started writing short stories. And I thought, well, I'm never going to be able to write more than a 10-page story. But I loved writing the short stories. And then suddenly I was writing 20-page stories, 35-page stories.
Wow.
And then it led to writing a novel. And I think it's the same thing with comedy, where I was sort of writing, you know, sketch and 3-minute bits for stand up. And then it was getting a little longer, and it's like, oh, let's do like a short film. And, you know, so you're running sprints at first, and then eventually you're running the marathon. You're learning, you know, I think Ernest Hemingway talked about that with, you know, short stories to novels, is you're learning how to run the longer races, you know, over time, as you do it more and you get used to it, you know.
So. Well, it's just so neat that you started writing short form, and then now you have, I mean, this is your first novel, one of many, and the cool thing about, you know, being a writer is it's a physical, you get a physical gratification from seeing it in print. Like, looking at your book, it's like, it's got to make you feel all the hours, years, whatever you spent on this.
Yeah.
It came to fruition, and now you physically see that you're a published author. There's nothing more gratifying than seeing that product. You're like, whoa, it It's here. It arrived.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I hadn't read the book, my own book.
Yeah.
So I decided I'm going to read it to come here today and do the interview. So I was sitting reading my own book for the first time. I was sort of like scared.
That's crazy.
To read the, you know,
why?
I've read it on my computer a million times. Right. But holding it as a physical entity and seeing my name at the top and, you know,
it's badass, title. Dude.
Oh, it's a
badass.
Great, yeah, it's a great.
And it was released maybe like 3 or 4 months ago, right?
Yeah, it was released in July.
Because I remember as soon as I saw your post, I'm like, we need to have you on the show because this is, I mean, it's a monumental thing to write a book. It's no small feat. It's like, you know, I write songs. That's an amazing thing just in that short art form. But the way I look at novelists or writers on that or screenwriters, it's a whole different beast. It's a whole different animal. And my respect is through the roof. You know what I mean? So like to have an organized thought, and I want to get to, you know, let's get to your book. How did you come up with just the process of writing this story? Like, tell us a little bit about the backstory, and then I want to get into some excerpts, but tell us about like what made you want to write this and how you came to the story.
You got it. Well, it's funny because it started with just a genuine fascination, like a lot of people, with the Kennedys, people have asked me, why are you so into President Kennedy or, you know, Jackie Kennedy, the Camelot thing, you know, because a lot of people are fascinated.
Totally.
By him.
And still.
I said, I think it has something to do with unrealized potential. Somebody who's, has all the makings, wants to say so much and change the world like President Kennedy did, and was gunned down at his peak, you know, something very just sad about that. And hand in hand with his brother, Bobby, it's really heartbreaking. And, when you got some people who really want to make a difference, you know,
Martin Luther King, shaking things up. Yeah, yeah.
Martin Luther King. I mean, the names go on and on of people who, you know, if they'd only gotten their full run, I think of like Vincent van Gogh, what would he have painted if he died at 37? So for someone who loves comedy so much, I do have a little eye on tragic figures.
I think they're kind of like they're back to back.
Oh, I think so.
You know, in a lot of ways,
hand in hand, I think. Yeah. There's something because the comedy grows out of the tragedy, you know, what's that expression? The, tragedy plus time equals comedy.
I've never heard that. That's great. That's great.
That's a good one. So I think it's part of the equation. So, but anyway, so I was so obsessed that I wrote a play called That November Day that takes place completely on board Air Force One, both going to and coming home.
Oh, wow.
From That's Dallas. Heavy. Oh, it's heavy. And there's a lot of characters and it's, you know, it's sort of what everybody on the plane went through, the senators, the wives, the people who got bumped up in their political careers, the people who got bumped down because, you know, this fate changed their whole lives. And so it took years to research it and read everything I could about this event and these people. Because I knew I couldn't write a play until I knew everything there was
to know.
Every perspective is a great point. And knew everything about the characters so that I could speak for them, you know?
Yeah.
And there'd be times where I'd be like, okay, I think I'm ready to start writing some dialogue. And the words would come out for some characters and not for others. And I knew I didn't know them well enough to speak for them. And that's a big burden trying to talk for
especially when they're living, breathing people, too.
Yes.
It's one thing if they're like a facet of your imagination.
Oh, yeah.
And you could still struggle with it not being developed there. But when they're actually living, breathing people that were all affected by this one event, you know, it's kind of crazy to try and live up to that.
Yeah. And I even say in this book, I say that, you know, you don't want descendants to come, you know, to come to you and say, President Kennedy would have never eaten fruit before an airport landing.
Right, right.
Yeah. The littlest things, you know.
Right, you're like, shit, Johnson. I missed that.
Yeah, yeah. Johnson used a you know, a nasal inhaler, you know, and not a you know, another kind of inhaler or something like that. There's all kinds of things that you're like, boy, I don't want to get caught not dotting my I.
Right, you know, like right. So well, and you can kind of go down a rabbit hole investigating maybe characters that aren't central to the story just to get those details too. So it's like this fine balance of like, okay, that's enough. I've got enough of the personality or the, you know, the social quirks of that character to present that.
Absolutely. Know? Yeah. No, you're right. At some point you got
to
just,
you got it. You got
to get at it.
Hey, this guy's not even the main guy. Or no, girl.
It was really funny. A great baseball analogy to that is there's a guy who managed for the Phillies for one season. His name is Ryan Sandberg, and he's a Hall of Famer from the Chicago Cubs. Well, he wanted to manage at every single level of baseball, like single A, double A, triple A. I think he was even doing like, you know, fall league manager, just because he wanted to be able to say, I've done it all and I'm ready for the major leagues. And when he finally got up to manage, he managed the Phillies, and it was a disaster.
It's a
so
different
over preparedness or nervousness of failing, or just he just sort of he'd been too, and maybe it was something in the nervousness, you know, that you know, or the over preparedness, just or doubtfulness of himself,
right?
That was the key element that led to his failure. But
that's crazy,
right? It's
what was the most peculiar thing you found out about any of the characters? Any kind of like, you know, weird detail that we would not know about this,
about
Jackie or JFK or Lyndon?
Well, I think one of my favorite ones is that is Jackie's voice, because if you've ever heard her speak on, you know, there's a lot of recordings of her, and she has this very whispery voice like this.
It's haunting.
It's haunting, but it's the same if you listen back to back to Marilyn and Jackie O.
Oh, wow.
It's the same speaking voice.
Wow.
And you speak about women, you know, today who are, you know, putting themselves out there and wanting to, you know, and wanting to do, to have strong careers and everything. Back then, Jackie was told by her dad, he said, his nickname was Blackjack. And he said, Jackie, if you want men to like you, you can't let them know how intelligent you are, because it'll intimidate them.
That's crazy.
So she adopted this mousy, whispery voice, so she would seem, seem to be a threat,
right,
or aloof, or not very smart. So she took on Marilyn's sort of, you know, dumb girl
voice. They were like kind of like two very powerful women.
Yeah, absolutely. But the interesting thing that I learned was that her public voice was the whispery one. But as soon as she went through that swinging door into the kitchen, she would be like, you know, all right, everybody, let's go. Get the food on the goddamn table.
That's awesome. She,
this real, and this is what the people that, who were in her employ said about her, was that she had a commanding voice in private and this whispery voice
in public.
In public, you know, she was sort of playing the role that she thought, you know, she was supposed to play in the 1960s, you know. So that was one pretty interesting thing to learn, that, you know.
And so your story is about a writer that writes about.
Yes. So it's basically, you know, I've gotten into this thing where I've sort of done a story within a story. So the story of me writing this play and getting obsessed with it, and we did a reading of the play, and you know, you're like, okay, we still need to find a Lyndon Johnson, you know, to play the role. We need a Lady Bird Johnson. And you're casting these people, and you're looking for a guy who looks like Lyndon Johnson.
Right.
Which is not easy to do, you know.
Right.
Right? And with the big old, you know, the big old
head.
Ears and the giant 6'5".
Face looks like a knuckle.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, anyway, so it was really, so many little funny things came out of it. And I was talking to a friend, he's like, He's like, you know, this is really interesting, funny stuff. You should write, you know, you should write this as a book or as a screenplay or something. And your journey through this obsession of wanting to create, you know, your own Camelot. You know,
right. and you being in the Camelot too, right?
Is right, right. The, it's basically a guy. Narrative. Yeah, he wants to sort of be the martyr JFK in the book, and he wants to cast, you know, his own Jackie Kennedy type, and then be on stage with her, and maybe if you know we're acting together and we're rehearsing together, we'll you know fall in love because he's fallen in love with Jackie through his research. And so it becomes him trying to create his own Camelot in the modern day era, you know. But he's such a neurotic,
yeah. I mean,
fool that he
loses himself.
Yeah, that he does. You know, he'll like you know, not that I did personally, but you know, he would just lie to get to impress people or to impress her or whatever, and then. Of course, in the end, you know, your lies add up and it backfires. And, you know, so that's, you know, pretty much what goes off for this poor bastard.
Well, let's read something from it. What do you want to read first?
Absolutely. Well, I'll read do you want me to read like the back?
Yeah, first read the back. Yeah,
taste
exactly.
Of what it's about.
Exactly.
Although I may have done that, but. So Andrew Brewster Crawford, a.k.a. ABC. A playwright obsessed with the glamour, glory, and gloom of the Kennedy era, has written a play about the last day of JFK's life. In order to cast himself as the martyred president, win the love of a beautiful Jackie Kennedy type, and live happily ever after in a Camelot of his own creation. He's got the great man down, the windswept haircut, the sailing-ready nautical digs, the Boston by way of Harvard accent, the easy witticisms to diffuse tension. But in ABC's quest to fashion himself after his hero, JFK, and mount his magnum opus, he conducts himself more like LBJ, a man who believed that the quickest route from point A to point B ran underground. O Jackie is a story about the internal and external chaos created when an artist with both a Superman and an inferiority complex, chooses to be the self he wishes he was instead of the self he truly is.
That was very, very well done.
So, yeah, so that...
You read your own words pretty well, man.
Thanks. I didn't know how that was going
to
go.
No, that was great. No, yeah, it was great to get a backstory like that.
Yeah, yeah, and I think... So a good friend of mine was reading this, and we spent like a whole night over beers just talking about the Superman versus inferiority complex,
right,
in people. And he said, you know, what drew you to that? And I said, I think that's just a lot of great characters for some reason, you know. I think George Costanza, to a degree, is that like he thinks he's better than everybody
it's
else.
It's man versus myth. It's,
yes.
But I mean, right. I think also some of the big, you know, heroes and martyrs still are like that. Yeah. Like, you know, watching a movie like Selma and seeing Martin Luther King smoking knowing that he was cheating on his wife. Like, you don't see right. that in the myth of who the person is. So
JFK the same way. Yeah,
totally. So like, that man versus myth thing is amazing to write about.
Yeah, it really is. I think, and it really says a lot about the humanity of people too, because you do, you know, believe in yourself to, you know, to a degree at certain times, you know, when you're on stage, you feel great. I know my wife, when she sings, she feels like she belongs up there.
Right.
And then, she'll find herself in a social situation at a party where she doesn't have that feeling of confidence like she does on stage.
Right.
You know, and in her element. And so I think it's such an interesting dynamic that you can be so confident, cool, and charismatic on stage with your instrument.
Yeah.
You know, or when you're in your element of whatever your element is. And then the next second, you know, you're somewhere else and you feel like a fool. I mean, you feel like you don't belong.
I think that's what every artist kind of, they dance on that border of, like Chris Martin said it, and I was like, this is so perfect. He said, every artist is like on the brink. It's like the perfect fine line of the most confidence in the world to the most insecure. And it, you're just teetering on both. You know what I mean? Because like every great artist feels insecure.
Yeah.
Every small artist feels mightier than thou, you know? And it's just, it will teeter. It'll switch. You know what I mean? It's just, it always is going to happen.
It's so interesting.
It is interesting. It's like, it's kind of why we probably do it, you know?
Because
it's not the same. We have to know both sides.
Right.
You have to know both sides of the coin to kind of make great art. And then even, you know, even when you make something great, you may not know it in the moment.
Yeah.
Like it has to just live past, you know, like there's so many composers that Mozart, he was buried in a ditch. We don't even know where he's buried.
Right.
He didn't
think
his
compositions
would last 500 years.
Yeah, Vincent van Gogh never got to know that, you know, what he had done. And now he's on a hunk of Gouda at the supermarket.
There's a bit right there.
Right. I mean, can you imagine if he came back to life and he's like picking out cheese and he's like, holy
he's
crap.
Like, that's me. That's
me.
That's me.
Right?
Totally.
He'd buy a lot of that cheese. Send it to all the
family. I'll take all of it.
I told you I was great.
Sending it back to all the haters. Yeah. Let's read something from the book.
Yeah. Well, this one, it's just a small little passage that I picked out. I thought that a lot of artists can relate to the place you go to do your work. And I work in two different places. I either work at home, at my desk completely, you know, alone, no one around when I want to focus in. Usually when I'm on the computer, typing in the dialogue or whatever, putting it together. But I usually start start with a notebook and a heck of a lot of coffee. And I just go and write, take notes and get familiar with the story. And then I go over the notes.
You can say cocaine.
Yeah. I take cocaine. No.
I'm just kidding.
No. But there's like different, it's really hard to find a place. I don't know how you feel when you're writing
songs. I feel the exact same.
But a place where you're like, this is my home away from home, my coffee house, my place. Well, there's a place, you may have gone to, called Abbott's Habit.
I don't know that place.
Abbott's Habit was a coffee shop on Abbot-Kinney Boulevard in Venice. And it was there for like maybe 23 years. And the people in there were zany,
eclectic, eccentric.
Yes, a guy with a frayed top hat who's drawing a rabbit. You know,
right, cool. Right?
He's actually in this book. You know that kind of, like really guys coming. There was once Elise and I were in there once when a guy came in, ran in with a giveaway bat from a Dodgers game. You know, one of those little miniature ones. And was like chasing some other guy, and there's an entrance and then an exit. And he was like chasing him. It was like, this is like Charlie Chaplin stuff right here, right? It was like, literally, we were scared for our lives, but, you know, he was really angry. And so I would see the most outrageous stuff. So it was really kind of creatively inspiring to see these people, you know, men in, you know, flowing, you know, gowns, you know, dresses. And
you're
you know,
I need to write in here.
Yeah,
this is like my imagination.
Yeah,
in a coffee
shop. Use these people,
for
the side characters or whatever. So, but it closed down maybe 2 years ago. And now I go to Bob Dylan's place on 18th Street.
I don't know that place.
You got to go there.
What's Bob
Dylan's
place?
Santa Monica, 18th and Broadway.
Okay.
He owns it. Bob Dylan. He owns the whole block. And there's a synagogue on the corner that he bought so it would stay open. It would never, like, he never raised the rent on them. He's just, you know, he's got a big heart. And he did the same thing, I think, with his coffee shop where he didn't raise the rent. And you can go in there. I've seen his son Jacob in there a couple of times. I've never seen him in there, but I'm waiting.
Wow.
You know, like, so, but he owns it. It's called the 18th Street Coffee House. So that's my new place now. But I used to go to this place on Abbot-Kinney Boulevard in Venice called The Habit. And this is sort of how I described it in the book. The Habit was home to the bohemian crowd, dreamers and down-and-outers who sat on scratched-up old church pews behind wobbly tables looking like they've been swept off the muddy battlefield at Woodstock. I liked working there because I could kick off my flip-flops and write in my bare feet, and Vera, the tattooed and dreadlocked owner, didn't seem to think it affected the success of her business. Showcasing no major hippie tendencies other than my affinity for letting my feet breathe, I really didn't fit in there, but I kept going back because the endless number of outlandish personalities and fashion styles passing through that slamming screen door inspired creativity. The food was decent, the coffee was bad, but fun to complain about. And there was always a beautiful young actress studying her lines to flirt with and help temper the emotional quality of my work.
Very nice. Woo! You know what was cool about that? I didn't want it to end because you were painting this picture, man. It was like I was waiting for the circus to come through there, you know?
Well, it's funny because I call the people there at one point when he's in an uproar, something that's happening in the plot, and he calls the clientele the freak menagerie.
Nice. One last question before we sign off. I want to ask you, and I also want to plug the book, Oh Jackie, the title.
Yeah.
Titles are important to me.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about the title. Like, why did you call it Oh Jackie?
Well, first of all, I was thinking earlier that it's Oh Jackie with an exclamation point, and I thought you might say, you know, why the exclamation point, which is part of your question right? And I thought, well, you know, no other titles have exclamation points, so that'll make mine stand out.
I like it. You're like marketing. I'll put an exclamation point.
It's red. It's bright red, and it's got an exclamation point. You've
like
got
it.
To at least open it, right?
That's right.
So, you know, she goes by Jackie O. So I just switched the O and the Jackie.
Oh.
And, you know, he obviously worships the main character, ABC, worships this icon, you know. So it's all about like how much he worships her. And I think at one point he says, I liked her more than anyone in history, mythology, real life.
Right.
You know, basically.
Well, it makes sense because she was such a huge influence for that time period too.
Yeah.
You know, everybody was looking for, and I think also like just having a feminine powerhouse go through a tragic event and still show not weakness but strength, and that's what she did.
Absolutely, yeah. And the change from the person she was before the assassination to the strong woman. I mean, it really shaped her into an extraordinary woman, where she was sort of a shrinking violet before, and sort of just didn't want to go on these political trips, and was scared, thought she was silly and not smart enough and not, you know, not impressive enough to be around all these dignitaries and incredible people. And she was dead wrong about that. And so she sort of became her true self after President Kennedy was gone. And I think that's what's so amazing about her is that she took this thing and turned it into a
great life. She came out of the shadow a little bit.
A very strong woman, yeah.
And where can people find your book?
So you can get it on Amazon. It's getting real good reviews on Amazon. You can get it at jnewbooks.com. That's my publisher.
Spell it out because people are dumb.
Yeah, it's jnewbooks.com. jnewbooks.com. And yeah, it's available all over the internet. You can also get it in bookstores across L.A., Pages in Manhattan Beach, Diesel in Brentwood, it's a cool bookstore there by the Brentwood Country Mart, and a bunch of other ones around LA. So if you want to go, you know, see it in person, you can get it that way. But and it's also available ebook form, hardback, paperback, and an audiobook by a guy named Carter Bellamy, who is as good a voiceover actor as I've ever heard. And I was just listening to it earlier, and And he does such a nice job of subtly creating these characters, that even the little side characters, it's amazing. He's turned into something, and just the right, you know, subtle touch of comedy. Now he doesn't push it, and his delivery, it's like a one-man show. It's a great performance, and we listened to about 1,000 voices before we found that guy. And
that's amazing.
So worth it.
You're like, that's the guy.
Oh, I started having
that's my Morgan Freeman.
1,000 voices in my head. Yeah, that's my Morgan Freeman. Exactly. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Alex, we're going to have you back.
Oh, I'd love it.
Please come back and visit us, dude.
So good.
What an extraordinary story, book, and an accomplishment, man. Dude. Oh,
thanks so much.
High five. Thank high five. You get the cock of approval. On behalf of Ronan, Eddie Pence, and myself, we'll see you guys next week.